Ladies and gentlemen, good day and welcome to the Nissin Desai Roundtable Conference, Roundtable Webinar. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode, and there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions after the presentation concludes. Should you need assistance during the conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star, then zero on your touch-tone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I now hand the conference over to Mr. Nishal Joshipura. Thank you, and over to you.
Thank you. A warm welcome to all the participants joining this webinar. As all of you are aware, Modi government came back to power with a thumping majority in May, despite agrarian crisis, slower GDP growth rate, and concerns around jobs. The newly formed Modi government presented its maiden budget on 5th of July. In this budget, there have been many firsts which have not been announced in the previous budget. The first and the foremost first in this budget has been the fact that after 72 years of independence, for the first time, the budget was presented by a woman finance minister, Ms. Nirmala Sitharaman. The second major first with respect to this budget has been the concept of startup team. Now, as all of you are aware, the three major initiatives which Modi government had started in 2014 were Startup India, Make in India, and Digital India. In this budget, the government has taken a lot of measures to boost startups and to move towards cashless economy. As far as the startup team concept is concerned, the idea behind the concept is to help the entrepreneurs learn ways to commence their new businesses and to help them scale up their ventures so that these ventures can become unicorns. The third major first in this budget is the concept of social enterprises. While we have all seen for-profit enterprises getting listed on stock exchanges, this is the first time the concept of social enterprises being listed on a social stock exchange has been mooted. This will help number of social entrepreneurs raise funds from public and ensure that sufficient liquidity is available with these social entrepreneurs to fund social ventures. Another first in this budget has been government's resolve to make India a $5 trillion economy by 2024. India is currently a $2.7 trillion economy, which means in 5 years we are almost looking at doubling the value of the economy, and this is going to be a Herculean task for the government. Another major first in this budget is the concept of zero interface with the tax department in tax assessments. This is going to be a huge factor as far as international investors are concerned, since in any tax assessment, the biggest concern that the investors have is corruption with the tax department. Through this interface where there won't be any tax officer involved directly with the taxpayer, the government aims at drastically reducing the corruption in tax assessments. In addition to this first, there have been many other significant announcements that have been made, especially for ailing sectors like NBFCs, non-banking finance companies, and for boosting the infrastructure investments in India. So there is a 70,000 crore recapitalization fund which is going to be used for funding the public sector banks, which in turn are going to take care of funding NBFCs, which in turn are going to help in developing the MSME sector, which is a major growth factor for the economy. As far as infrastructure investments is concerned, the government has planned to spend 1 lakh crore in the next 5 years towards infrastructure investment. So overall, the budget focuses a lot on infrastructure, financial services, and there have been many other relaxations which have been proposed with respect to foreign investment limit in various sectors. What I'll do now is I'll introduce the panel and we'll get into details on some of the significant tax and non-tax proposals which have been announced in the budget. To my right is Rajesh Simon. He heads our international tax practice. To my extreme right is Ashish Sodhani. He's a senior member in international tax practice. To my left is Richi Sancheti, who heads our fund formation practice. And I'm Nishal Joshipura. I head the corporate practice in the firm. My first question is to Richi. And Richi, there have been number of announcements which have been made with respect to foreign portfolio investors.
Correct.
Are they positive? Are they negative? Is this what the industry had represented? Is the industry happy with the proposals, or is there something more that needs to be done?
Sure. So I think I'll take the cue from how you introduced that it is now a stated policy for the government to make India a $5 trillion economy. And accordingly, evolving India into an investment-friendly destination is definitely what sort of is you know, flowing through the entire budget presentation the way it has come out. There are certain changes in how some of the provisions have been drafted, vis-a-vis that some of the aspects or some of the impact on FPIs may not have been fully thought through. But I'll now take through one of the instances. For example, there was an introduction of enhanced surcharge for non-corporate entities. Now, FPIs were not kept in mind, but having said that, the impact is such that FPIs are today looking at taxes up to 21% in case of short-term capital gains, up to 14% in case of long-term capital gains, and so on and so forth. Our direct impact also falls on Category 3 AIFs, which too are similarly looking at up to 42% of tax rates, making some of these products somewhat unattractive to the investors when they compare this to some other modes of investment. Having said that, going with the overall flow that we want to enhance India's sort of receptiveness to FPIs, some very critical measures which have been, you know, been asked by the industry for a long time have been taken up. The first one I would like to talk about is expansion of, you know, the bandwidth that Indian companies had to absorb FPI investments. From 24%, it is now being proposed to increase it up to sectoral limit. I think what had happened in the past is that Indian companies had only passed resolutions allowing FPI investments to go above 24%, but it was done on a very ad hoc basis. Now, SEBI and other regulators have been taking a lot of feedback from global, you know, participants, including MSCI and other index makers, and accordingly to allow an increase in bandwidth so that the free float also improves. This combined with other sort of policies to increase the public participation in public equity companies, public company listed companies up to you know, only 35% should be opened up. I think this should add to the overall free float and increase the India's weightage on the MSCI and other indices. The second proposal has been to club the portfolio investment scheme route for NRIs along with the FPI. Again, this is something which has seen several policy flip-flops in the last couple of years, especially when NRIs for the first time to begin with asked not to be beneficial owners of FPIs. They could not sort of participate in any FPI beyond 25% on an individual basis or more than 50% on as a collective pool basis. Again, here, if the proposal is taken up, which is to combine the portfolio investment scheme route meant for NRIs with foreign portfolio investors, then what would happen is it would allow a very free flow, unified mechanism for NRIs to participate in Indian equities alongside other investors in the FPI program. This again is subject to further inter-regulatory discussions. RBI so far has been the regulator, the nodal regulator for NRI inflows into India. And these are heavy proposals to sort of take forward because this is the FPI regime at the end of the day. So it needs to be seen how the two regulators sort of put together the overall mechanism to harmonize the platform. The next piece I would like to talk about is the entire issue around the 9A relaxation, where we provide safe harbors when India domestic managers are managing offshore pool. Now, again, here as a matter of relaxation, the proposal has been that as long as the eligible fund meets the corpus requirements within of 1 billion rupees, which is about 100 crores, within 6 months of the approval or at the end of the fiscal year, it should satisfy the 9A condition to that extent. And accordingly, it's a good news for newer fund setups who don't have to make sure that the corpus is up there. Already they have some amount of timely bandwidth attached to it, and accordingly they can meet the requirements on a going forward basis. I think those were the key proposals for the portfolio investors.
In your experience, has anybody availed of the advantage of safe harbor?
I'm aware of nine such positive rulings which have come out. I think again it's a mixed bag of sorts whether to avail of the 9A benefits or not, because a lot of the portfolio investors still have either a traditional offshore structure where the India team is still providing advisory services, and they obviously are efficiencies on management fees and GST related aspects. And again, to have the entire management team come to India, what other implications does it have when and some of the strategies that we're talking about. So now today, the GIFT study has also evolved. So it's also a question of should we look at 9A on a standalone basis or should we look at GIFT study, which again is something that we can touch on from a budget proposal perspective.
Sure. Okay. Rajesh, we have been moving more from real tax to fictional tax. Right, in the past few years, there have been many sections which have been introduced in the Indian Income Tax Act, where on fictional income, there is tax that has been levied by the government. One such example is Section 56, where upon issuance of shares, if it is shares are issued above fair value, then it is considered as taxable in the hands of the Indian company. Any changes which have been proposed in the budget with respect to that, and is there something more that could have been done than what has been announced in the budget?
Thanks, Rishal. I think there have been two broad set of changes when we talk about share issuances. I think as everyone is aware, this has been a long debated matter now for the last few years. I think most startups, if you go to them, you will realize that there are some kind of notices or proceedings which are currently underway in respect of previous share issuances which they have done to various investors. And the challenge around it is that sometimes the quantum of demands which come in effectively is a pretty absurd set of demands which come in. So there has been a lot of representations which have been made to the government over the last few years to say that, listen, this is a provision when you're talking about trying to tax capital issuances, that there is an inherent problem because you're no longer trying to tax income, but you're taxing capital. And especially with the way it has actually been enforced by the tax authorities, it's created a lot of angst in the startup community. The budget has tried to address it through two-prong method. One was where they have said that in case of any cases which you are currently, where assessing officers are issuing notices, they have tried to provide for a safe harbor to say that so long as a startup or an eligible startup has filed the necessary declarations and filings with the tax authorities, they will not be questioned. Now, they've not set out as to what are the declarations or what are the tax filings that they're expecting the startups to make. But presumably that is going to provide a window whereby at least it will ensure that where today 7 out of 10 cases is going to be a question that's raised, it will at least reduce that significantly. Added to this, they've also said that assessing officer should take the approval of the senior officer, which will be the principal commissioner or whoever it is that they identify, before they initiate any proceedings. This will hopefully at least ensure that you do not have a situation where notices are going out left, right, and center, which is what has been happening, and at least to reduce the quantum of litigation around it. So this is one set of change. We have to see in terms of the fine print around it in terms of what declarations, what filings are required, but at least this will hopefully reduce litigation to a significant effect. The second aspect that they have also said is that today there was a safe harbor which was available where a startup was issuing shares to a category 1 AIF to say in those cases we are not going to question valuation. Now, category 1 AIF are social venture funds, venture capital funds, separate identified set. But that was only a small subset in the AIF universe. In fact, a large majority of the AIFs which have been set up in India have been set up as category 2 AIF, which is a much more broader ambit. What the budget has essentially done is to extend the safe harbor to say that even if you're issuing shares to a category 2 AIF, we are not going to go in and question. It's subject to our absolute safe harbor, which is there, which is actually good because today, at least insofar as the pool of domestic investors are concerned, category 2 AIF is probably the largest majority. And to that extent, you have sort of ensured that that's the easier path that is available. What was expected or what was really hoped was that they just removed the provision out of the book because, to be honest, it was unnecessary provision which was there. Or probably extended it to any kind of investments from regulated entities, which would have again been, because the intent here of the provision was essentially to ensure that there are no fraudulent situations or there are no fund diversions which are happening, which would have been sorted if you had just said that any regulated entities making an investment will exempt it. But at least it's still a good move because you're still opening up a larger pool where the issue of questioning reduces. So that's one set of changes which the government did as far as startups are concerned. Couple of other tweaks that they have done for startups. One was in respect of carry forward of loss, where earlier there was special dispensation for startups on carry forward of loss to say that if there's 100% continuity of shareholding and the losses were incurred in the last 7 years, you will get the benefit of the carry forward of loss. In case of non-startups, you had the requirement of if more than 51% of the shareholders who were shareholders of the company in the year the loss was incurred continue to be shareholders in the year where the carry forward wants to incur, where a company wants to carry forward the loss, then the loss would be allowed. Since there were two different provisions, what the government essentially did was for a startup, you meet any of the two conditions, you will get the benefit of carry forward loss. Limited benefit, you'll have to look at it on a case-specific scenario. And I think the last one, again, going to be a very limited impact as far as startups are concerned, is what I call a rollover benefit, where if you've got capital gains or somebody has got capital gains in respect of transfer of residential property, they have the ability to invest that in a startup and get a rollover of the capital gains tax benefit. That is also, there's been some degree of tweaks around it. But again, I would look at it as a limited sort of benefit because that's a very small pool that you're looking at. But more than anything else, I think the Section 56 was a deemed fiction around capital, around the income from other sources. I think that's been the biggest benefit or takeaway from the budget.
And it's not just limited to startups because now Category 2 AIFs are also allowed to take benefit of the exemption.
That's
which means that even in growth companies, if the investment is happening at above fair value, then there won't be any income tax issue for those companies.
Okay.
So that's a welcome move from the government. Rishi, over to you. You have been advising number of offshore and domestic GPs in setting up investment funds in GIFT City. Is there any major announcement with respect to setting up of funds in GIFT City which the GP should, you know, be aware of?
Sure. So I think if you look at funds which are focused on India, either the managers are outside, in which case you are comparing a GIFT City structure with a FPI platform, which is completely offshore. The other scenario is for a domestic team, which could either set up a Category 3 AIF in India versus setting up a GIFT-based platform again. Now, as far as the Category 3 AIF, the onshore fund managers were concerned, the key issue for them was around the lack of any certainty around the taxation of the entire regime. It's been quite some time when Category 1 and 2 AIFs were treated formally under a separate tax code evolved for them under the Tax Act. Nothing on similar lines was ever announced for Category 3 AIFs, which was by and large relying on tax pass-through, which is available to any trust structure setup. It has been a wish for the industry for a long while that let there be some position clarity. either there will be a fund level taxation so that the category 3F pays taxes and the investors again are passed to because tax has been paid, or let there be a unit level taxation as it operates in case of mutual funds where the equity oriented funds do not pay taxes but investors sort of pay taxes at the time of redemption. Unfortunately, none of these positions have yet been firmed up by the industry. There still remains a big issue around it. Second, whenever there is a management fee paid to the manager, there is a GST leakage over and above that aspect as well. Now, if we were to look at a gift setup to sort of see how a domestic fund manager could leverage on that, there are a few challenges which still remain. To begin with, as a sponsor, if they were to remit funds, are they yet to clear the position whether it would be under automatic route or not? Can Indian sponsor entities remit funds directly or would they have to take approvals and what is the position around it? The next piece is that investments coming from a gift city structure to India would be under the FPI program, which means that while there is a lot of certainty on tax position because FPI investments are deemed to be capital assets in nature, and accordingly there is a, you know, sort of certainty on the characterization of income. The challenge remains that once they invest under the FPI program, but the pooling platform has been set up in a category 3 format in GIFT City, they are hit by both the whammies of a category 3F cannot invest more than 10% of its corpus, and at the same time, an FPI cannot acquire more than 9.99% shares of an Indian company. Unfortunately, the way the regulations today operate, both the restrictions hit. And accordingly, it is very unfortunate that concentrated portfolios or certain strategies just cannot be deployed in a gift city sort of a structure. Having said that, there is a relaxation on the business income for any unit operating out of gift, and accordingly, management entities and so on and so forth set up in gift could now avail of a tax holiday, so to speak, for any block of 10 years from the 15 years of their incorporation, so on and so forth. So that's an extension on the ATLA exemption that was available. On the other hand, GST again is not sort of looked at because these are deemed to be export of services to a gift-based structure. Having said that, what is the adequate amount of CV presence you should have in gift to sort of justify your claim to the exemption and so on and so forth? Again, it's something which, you know, managers will have to rely on advisors. Having said that, has the time for AIF and gift come? Answer, unfortunately, is still no. There are still quite a few gaps. Again, it is not within the scope of a budget proposal to sort of refine all that. But what the industry would definitely look with a lot of interest is that now the triarca of SEBI, RBI, Ministry of Finance have definitely come together to make GIFT a success. And they are definitely looking at it as something which could compete with the erstwhile overseas, you know, jurisdictions we have been looking at for all these while. So I would definitely say that the intent is there. So the rules and mechanisms have unfortunately not been laid out the way we would have expected. But having said that, I think give it another quarter or two, hopefully we would see some more progressive stances being taken by the different agencies of the government towards this.
Mr. Student, you have been actively involved in making representations to the government on this?
Correct. So I think we have been advising a few industry bodies as well as fund manager lobbies on how to sort of operate structures out of gift. I think the key issues have been that how does SEBI look at it? Because there's clearly a need to harmonize the regimes. While we do not have any pooling vehicle regulations in GIFT, and that's why AIF regulations were taken as is to operate in GIFT, we do expect that as soon as the unified regulator is sort of formalized, there is a dedicated regulatory body instituted just to operate on GIFT, which will have the powers of both RBI, SEBI, and so on and so forth, and it has adequate representation from Minister of Finance as well. We believe that as soon as that unified regulator sort of comes into office, we would see a lot of these rules sort of harmonizing. We would definitely wish that a tax of a CBDT member is also inducted so that even when the regulations are designed ground up, the tax elements also taken up so that we can avoid unnecessarily tax related back and forth and confusion with the operators.
So Rajesh, my next question is to you. In the previous Modi government, there was a lot of impetus that was given to alternative investment fund industry. In fact, this is one government which has actually taken serious interest in promoting the venture capital and private equity industry. And we saw a slew of changes, including pass-through status that was given to Category 1 and Category 2 AIF in Modi 1.0. Now, in Modi 2.0, in the first budget, what are the changes which have been proposed with respect to pass-through for Category 1 and 2 AIF?
Sure. So when it came to AIF, you've always had the long-standing debate of ensuring that there is absolute pass-through which actually comes through. You didn't have provisions in the first place. Then a special provision was introduced, which actually provided for what I would call as a partial pass-through. Because what the earlier provisions essentially put it into two or three different buckets. There was a pass-through in respect of all income other than business income. But if there was a loss situation, there was no pass-through. The loss had to be absorbed at the AIF level and offset against future years. So what it effectively led was to a situation where investors were being taxed on the gains, but when it came to losses, that was not technically being passed on to the investors, because each investor would have a different position. Because let's say if somebody had invested in three AIF, in one there was profits, in one there were losses which were coming through. Ideally, they would have wanted to offset it. But the way the provisions were worded was that only the profits could be passed through back to the investors, but not the losses. That was something which this government or this budget has tried to address, to say that we are not going to restrict the pass-through only to profits and gains apart from business income. But we are also going to extend it in respect of any losses. And we are talking about losses, we are essentially talking about capital losses more than anything else. Where they have said that, okay, we are going to allow you to pass through the capital losses, or we are going to pass through losses other than business losses, subject to a couple of different conditions. One, the investor should have held the units in the AIF for at least a 12-month period. So that the idea or the intent behind is very clearly to say that, listen, we want to have only, because in the AIF situation, you don't really have too many secondaries happening at the LP level. So, but what they are looking for is that we want the long-term investors who are actually sitting in should take the benefit of the losses or the pass-through. The second set of changes that they have said is that they've tried to address for the past also, to say that any losses which have been incurred till 31st March 2019, that will also get, there will be a pass-through of that to the existing investors in the AIF. When it comes to the situation where they're talking about the losses till 31st March 2019, they've not put in any conditionality of a 12-month holding or anything. So that gets passed through in absolute. In respect of any losses going forward, you need to have held the units for a 12-month period. I think a couple of small anomalies which come in, because in a classical AIF setup, what you really have is every time there's a drawdown, fresh units are issued. The intent of the government, and at least the way units are defined under the AIF regulations, it does not translate to you having held all the units for a 12-month period, but I think the intent was more from the fact that the LP should have been an investor in the fund for the last 12 months. So hopefully, I don't think that should create too much of a problem. So at least to a large extent, what you are now closer to the global practices, I would say, by ensuring that pretty much there is an absolute pass-through which is available under most circumstances in respect of any income which is generated by AIF. Now, really, the only thing which is mostly left out is Category 3 AIF, which still has not been addressed in terms of Category 3 AIF, whether tax at the AIF or at the LP level. Most AIFs, Category 3, still tax it at the AIF level. But I think that's today the only area which is left in terms of trying to resolve the pass-through issue.
Sure. In fact, this proposal is going to majorly benefit venture capital, GPs and LPs, because the typical venture capital fund model would be out of 10 investments made, maybe 7 or 8 might fail, but 1 or 2 investments which make money, you know, that clocks the overall IRR for the fund. Now, earlier what used to happen is that only for the 1 or 2 blockbuster investment which used to make money, there was a pass-through available in terms of the income, which means the LPs or the investors were taxed. But the losses arising on account of the failed investment were available only to the AIFs and not passed on to the LPs or the investors. Now with this pass-through for the losses also in addition to the income, this is going to be a major boost for the IRR for the LPs, because they will be able to offset these losses against the taxable income, which in turn is going to increase the returns to the ultimate investor. So clearly this is a major change from an LP return perspective, and a welcome move from the government. Ashish, my next question is to you. What we saw was earlier pre-2013-14, there were number of buybacks which took place where the shareholder was a Mauritius entity. And at that time, the capital gains tax was levied on the shareholder. And because the shareholder was coming from a treaty jurisdiction, there was no capital gains tax on the repatriation of profits from India. Then the government plugged this loophole and introduced this concept of income distribution tax, where if an Indian company does buyback, there's a tax. Is there any further change to that which has been announced in this budget?
Sure. Thanks, Michelle. So, like you said, the Indian company in case of the distribution tax was an Indian unlisted domestic company where the buyback tax was introduced. The budget now introduces or enlarges this to go on to public listed companies as well, wherein any public listed company also wanting to do a buyback would have to pay tax at 20% at the level of the buyback. Now, in a situation where the public listed company needs to do a buyback, there are two reasons why this is absurd. One, that the original shareholder of the listed company may not be the current shareholder of the company because of the way listed companies are traded. Therefore, the new shareholder may not be able to get a deduction of the cost of acquisition. Therefore, the whole amount which he had actually paid for the shares becomes taxable. The second is that from a return of investment perspective, this may not be very very good for the shareholders, as even though there may be bona fide reasons for the public listed company to carry out the buyback.
Okay. Rajesh, my next question to you is, India has slowly been moving from a destination for equity investment to a destination for debt investment, right, with some of the treaties which have been amended in the last few years, giving more benefit for debt investment as compared to equity investment for foreign investors. Any major changes with respect to debt investment in India, both by domestic and foreign investors?
So I think if you look at what the government has tried to do, on the debt side, I think you can categorize it into two different sets of changes, one on the tax and one on the regulatory front. The regulatory front changes have been focused towards NBFCs, whereas the one on the tax front has been focused both on NBFCs and also on offshore borrowings. If I try to summarize all of them, what the government has recognized is that they have realized that there has been a lot of stress in the NBFC sector. And we've seen this starting from September of last year when the IL&FS fiasco happened. From that time onwards, we are seeing that there has been a lot of liquidity crisis in the market. I wouldn't call it a solvency crisis, but I would call it a liquidity crisis. So what the government has really done is look at, one, saying that how do we support the NBFCs, for which they made certain changes on the regulatory front. First one is to boost securitization, whereby NBFCs can actually downsell pools of loans to public sector banks. They have provided for a six-month credit backstop scheme, whereby the government will be sitting, is willing to sit down and guarantee the first 10% of the loss in respect of any of these securitization transactions with public sector banks. And this has been announced for a quantum of around 10,000 crores or $1.4 billion. There are certain caveats which the government had sort of announced. It talks about NBFCs which are well managed, or pools of loans which are credit worthy. So we do have to see how this is actually implemented in practice. But today one of the biggest challenges has been that the market has completely stopped in terms of the way, in terms of there being liquidity in the market. But I think this will at least ensure that public sector banks come in, get into the action to take some of these assets or loans off the balance sheet of NBFCs, provide liquidity for NBFCs. So this is overall a positive move. It was expected something like the TARP program in the US, that there would be a bigger liquidity window or something along those lines announced for NBFCs. We did not get that, but at least this is still a good start, because even a credit enhancement sort of at least ensures that the market moves, because today one of the biggest challenges has been that nobody wants to do the trade. But at least this will ensure that, okay, there is some amount of action over the next few months, which will ensure that NBFCs get back to better health and at least the market starts moving again. That's one bit of changes. The second bit of change, again, for NBFCs is that today when you're talking about public issuances of debt or NCDs as compared to private issuances, you're supposed to maintain a debt redemption reserve or a DRR. The government realized that there is an anomaly between public issuances and private issuances, with private issuances not having to do a DRR, while public issuances have to do a DRR. So they have removed the necessity or the need for the DRR to be done for public issuances. Again, the idea behind this is that all of this is that it just increases the amount of float which is available in terms of use of funds. The two sets of changes on the tax front which the government has done is, one, the government has started to recognize that NBFCs probably need to be further on par with banks. And to that extent, today banks had the advantage or the benefit that if there was a bad debt or an NPA, they can essentially not recognize the interest from the loans until such time they actually realize it. So the ability to create provisions, write-off and all of that, and being treated for tax purposes, that until you actually realize it, you're not going to be taxed on it, was there for banks. In case of NBFCs, that was not really there. Matter has been litigated, subject to a lot of debate in courts, decisions or both ways. Tax authorities have still been challenging that no, NBFCs still have to recognize the interest even on bad debts or NPA. The government has clarified that, put them on par with banks to say that, well, when it comes to bad debt or NPA, you will have to recognize it only in the year that you actually receive it. Now, this is good because I think the government is recognizing that more than anything else, all my provisioning and other requirements stem from RBI guidelines. There is a regulator who is there for NBFCs. The regulator determines or gives the path in terms of how to actually account. And what the government has essentially said, okay, let's follow in terms of what is being done for banks and extend that to NBFCs. So that's one, again, more clarification is what I would say in terms of setting out the position of law. But at least what you're trying to do is taking the pressure of the system in terms of unnecessary litigation or issues along those lines. The other change which is also there, which is again on the tax side, is around the fact that there were certain exemptions which were given in respect of interest withholding by way of a circular or a press release that was given, that if you're issuing RDBs or rupee denominated bonds where the prescribed interest rate is beyond the prime lending rate and 50 basis points, then for this year there will not be any withholding. They just put that into writing because it was there effectively as a press release. So that is again big change which has happened. And I think the last point which I will just mention around the whole NBFC crisis and the stress in the sector is the government, again, similar to the way that they were saying that, okay, we are going to treat NBFCs closer to banks, they've also increased the regulatory supervision of control which the Reserve Bank of India can have over NBFCs to give RBI the power to restructure or take over the management or replace the management of NBFCs. under certain circumstances. This is a power which the RBI has had in respect of banks, where they've had the ability, for example, to nominate a director on a bank, which we have seen it being recently exercised in one case, or have the power to essentially remove the board, replace the management of banks. Again, all coming in from the recognition that these are systemically important institutions. And I think we've had recent statements coming in from RBI also, where they have said that whether it is HFCs, whether it's NBFCs, all of these NBFC going down can have a systemic risk to the whole financial services sector. That's something RBI had come out with recently during the monetary policy. But the changes all go towards the fact that there is a recognition that NBFCs have been occupying a much larger space in the financial services space. So you need to provide both. You need to provide support, but you need to provide proper oversight also around NBFC. So that's what we've seen. A similar change along the same lines was also in case of HFCs, where you've had a situation where the existing nodal regulator who was there, which was the National Housing Bank, has moved back to RBI to say that let the RBI actually take control in terms of regulations around housing finance companies. So overall, I think you have to look at all of this as a package, not look at them in isolation. But what they've tried to do is to see, okay, how do we bring in enough liquidity and credit support to NBFCs at this point in time? And second, how do we increase our supervision and oversight over financial institutions, not just banks, but also NBFCs and housing finance companies, get them all within the RBI framework. So that's what they've done. At least the financial services space expect a bit more? Maybe they may have, but we are still at a good start around this. I think that's how I look at it.
Sure. Ashish, any major changes in M&A space?
Sure. So I think 2 points that I would like to bring out here, Michelle. I think the first one goes back to your point on taxing notional income.
Mm-hmm.
In 2017, the finance minister had come up with a provision of the PCA where they were taxing unlisted companies on the fair market value of the shares. So to give you an example, when the seller of these unlisted companies were selling the shares at less than fair market value, the fair market value was considered to be the deemed sale consideration. And any difference between the consideration and the FMV were also being taxed as capital gains. And this read with Section 56 resulted in an economic double taxation because the transferor and the transferee both were being subject to tax in India. Now to resolve this, the situations where there were unrelated parties and genuine transactions were taking place, the budget has provided some relief, where they have said that the consideration on transfer of shares, they are going to come out with a list of transactions which will not be subject to Section 56A. The second amendment that I would like to talk about is the relaxation for demergers. Now, today, for a tax neutral demerger to take place, the assets and liabilities of the demerging company should be reflected in the resulting company. But in cases where the resulting company is following an Ind AS method of accounting, it is not possible to do so. To ensure that this is now possible, the budget provides that even if the resulting company follows an Ind AS method, the assets and liabilities from the demerging company can be recorded under the Ind AS method in the resulting company's books, and the demerger will be considered to be a tax-neutral demerger.
So you mean to say the change has been from recording at book value to recording at fair value as per Ind AS?
That's right.
Understood.
Okay. Yeah, so I think that the demerger is, again, when you look at it at a macro level, what the government has tried to do in this budget is to fix some of the common problems for which, again, there's been a lot of discussion, representation, which has happened over the last year. And that's really what they have focused on, which in some sense is a good thing. But again, we can come back to that. But Nishal, let me just take it back to you, because I know we've spoken a lot about some of the tax and the financial services, but there were a lot of other amendments or announcements which came in the budget on the regulatory side, and more specifically around the foreign direct insurance, foreign direct investment. So why don't you throw some light around it?
Sure. In fact, finance minister has made some policy announcement with respect to liberalization of certain sectors, which will go a long way in attracting more foreign investment in some of these sectors. The first major one is the insurance sector, which is right now attracting maximum attention from international investors. The way the foreign investment policy works with respect to insurance currently is there is a limit of 49% which has been prescribed for foreign investment in insurance under automatic rule, and any foreign investor cannot go beyond 49% in this sector. And this applies both to insurance companies and insurance intermediaries like insurance broker or a third party administrator or a corporate agent. What the budget has made this announcement is with respect to insurance intermediaries, this limit of 49% on foreign investment will be increased to 100%, which means that an insurance brokerage entity or a third-party administrator entity can be 100% owned by a foreign investor. This is going to result in number of M&As once the policy is announced. Since we are aware about number of transactions which are already there where stake of more than 51% has to be sold to acquirers, and no Indian acquirer has financial wherewithal to acquire this stake to the extent of 51%, which means you need foreign money to acquire controlling stake in some of this insurance intermediaries, which was not possible earlier. But now with the relaxation of limit from 49% to 100%, we will see number of M&As taking place in the insurance intermediary space. The second major announcement which has been made by the finance minister is with respect to insurance sector also, there could be liberalization in this 49% foreign investment limit, which means that it could go up to either 74% or 100%. And there will be a paradigm shift in which the insurance industry will work going forward, because till date, government's insistence has been on the fact that all insurance companies should be Indian-owned and controlled. And if the foreign investment limit is increased beyond 49%, it will result in the Indian insurance company being foreign-owned or controlled. Which means that the likes of Prudential and AXA and some of the large insurance companies will be able to increase their stakes in Indian insurance companies beyond 50%, which is going to be a significant game changer for the Indian insurance industry, which is always cash-strapped on account of the solvency and other requirements that are applicable to the insurance companies. The other major sector where policy announcement has been made is aviation, and this was expected given the fact that Jet Airways is in distress and Air India is also up for sale. The way the current foreign investment policy works, it becomes difficult to attract foreign airlines to acquire stake in some of these Indian airline companies. So there is a proposal where there could be a proposal where a 49% stake by foreign airline could be increased beyond 49% so that foreign airlines are able to take controlling stake in the domestic airlines. However, what the FMS said is that this will be discussed with the relevant regulator and then a call will be taken. But given the two major cases that the government is facing right now, possibility of these changes cannot be ruled out. The third major sector where the announcement has been made is media. Again, it's a bit cryptic. We don't know whether it's going to be for print media or for broadcast or for animation and some of the other sectors. But at high level, government has mentioned that they want to open up the media sector also to foreign investment further. The fourth major sector has been single brand retail, where 100% foreign investment is permitted under automatic rule, subject to 30% local sourcing requirements. And 30% local sourcing requirement was becoming a big issue for some of the high-end companies like Apple, where, you know, they need to maintain the quality of their products. It was not possible to meet with the 30% local sourcing requirements, which could match up to the quality standards. So there is going to be some relaxation that we are going to see in foreign investment with respect to single brand retail also. One other major change, again, which is a policy announcement and government has mentioned that they will discuss with SEBI, is the relaxation of minimum public shareholding limit, where 25% is going to be increased from 25 to 35%. There will be number of implications if this proposal is accepted by SEBI. The first major implication could be some of the existing listed companies where the promoter stake is very high. They may want to delist these companies to avoid any further increase in the public shareholding. And the 75% promoter shareholding threshold was somewhere converging with the special resolution threshold under Companies Act, where 3/4 of the shareholders can pass a special resolution which are required for certain specific critical matters which the company needs to pass. With the 65% threshold and with the present and voting concept as far as the general meetings are concerned, it might become slightly tricky for the promoters to pass some of the special resolutions if the public shareholders out of 35%, 25% reject the proposal. And that's where this threshold is of significance as far as the promoter shareholders are concerned. The other major impact of this proposal could be we might see massive promoter stake sales happening in the market, where on one end the government will also benefit from the capital gains tax when the promoters sell this sell their stake. Especially in situations where the company does not need additional funds, there won't be any option left with the promoter but to sell their stake. But where the companies need more capital, they'll be able to dilute the promoter stake by 10% so the promoters are reduced from 75 to 65%. And traditionally, Indian listed companies have had higher promoter stakes compared to what we see globally, and hence there will be a lot of restructuring that will be required for promoter stake, large promoter stakes in listed companies to adhere to this requirement. So broadly, Rajesh, these have been the major changes on FDI front as far as the budget announcements are concerned. One question to Ashish, is there anything else, any other major announcement which has been made which you would want to highlight other than what we have discussed?
Sure. So one thing that I would like to state is that today when money or property was being gifted or being transferred to a non-resident, mm-hmm. the non-resident was claiming that to be not to be accruing or arising in India. Now, the budget has widened the tax net and said that even in situations where a resident transfers money or property to a non-resident, the non-resident will be subject to tax in India because it is deemed to accrue or arise in India. Now, this is again widening the tax base, like I said. This is one change that the budget has come up with. The second is with respect to transfer pricing provisions, where there has been an amendment on the secondary adjustment. Because of its technical nature, I'm not getting into it, but it's a welcome move for transfer pricing also that the budget has made.
Sure. Any misses? We have discussed about what all changes have been introduced, but any misses in the budget?
So I think when you start looking at the budget, right, as a sort of path for the next 5 years, while we have discussed a number of changes, I think a couple more that we probably didn't spend time on. One was around the bank recapitalization. The government has budgeted around $10 billion for bank recapitalization in the current year. And the second big change where the government announced that they are going to be tapping the foreign markets directly for raising debt rather than just relying upon domestic debt markets for raising debt, which again, both of these are moves which free up liquidity in the domestic market for lending to private institutions. I think that's the way I would see it. I think the question which really comes in and where I see really the misses are that at the time where we are grappling with two or three major challenges, one, there is not enough private spend on CAPEX. Second, consumption has slowed down. Third, we are seeing stress on the NBFC sector and on the real estate sector. So these are where I call the four places where there has been a lot of issues which are currently there. Have there been moves which are there which have addressed some of the specific issues around these four aspects? And that's where I think I would tend to think that the answer is not really and yes. Could there be incentives given for private companies to increase their capex or increase capacity? The answer is yes. The budget could have provided for certain tax breaks or incentives for the increase in private spend and capex. Could the budget have made moves to increase the liquidity for a common man? The answer is no. The budget has not really done too much around that. If anything, it has sort of sucked liquidity out of the system, I would call, in two different ways. One, increasing the taxes on the highest tax bracket. Second is things like buyback tax for listed companies. Those are places where I would say that there were options that were available whereby you would sort of free up the liquidity in the system. I don't really see those changes happening. NBFCs, more could have been done. Again, changes were positive, but more could have been done. And I think the last one, the real estate sector, which has a sort of a cascading impact on multiple different sectors. Again, we know that they are in a crisis. Could there be moves or aspects which the government could have done to increase the appetite of investors to invest into real estate or even buy a house and all? Those are aspects which I think the government has not really sort of spent time on. I think the way I would classify the budget is they've tried to tinker around and fix the small fixes while trying to give a path for some of the big changes. But have the big changes really come? The answer is no, not really.
See, from a funds industry perspective, I think it's again been a stated ask from the industry that could the government reconsider the rate of GST, which is applicable on management fee. See, I think if we want to onshore the fund management industry, get a lot of structures to come down to India, we'll have to encourage domestic fund management, and the clear way to look at it is, can we reduce the GST? Like export of services, when you have an offshore structure and India-based management team, there is no GST applicable because these are deemed export. Whereas in the onshore case, you have a 18% leakage on top of the management fee. I think the government may wish to relook at it so that you can encourage more India-based management teams and businesses. We've already glossed on how there is a complete lack of clarity on tax regime for Category 3 AIFs. It again defies the stated principle that we want to onshore the fund management industry. So Category 3 AIF would have been a best way possible for it. I think the last SEBI records show that 42,000 crores have been mobilized to Category 3 AIFs. Now, for such a massive pool of capital to operate without clarity on tax positions is again something which really hurts the industry. While we have seen a lot of sovereign pension participation on a global basis in Indian sort of products across Category 1 and Category 2 AIFs, Category 3 AIFs are yet to meaningfully take off as far as overseas investors are concerned. I think apart from the GST-related aspect, another piece the Minister of Finance could have looked at is, could they as a matter of policy come out with a position that overseas investors on whose behalf taxes have been paid at the full rate in force and so on and so forth, they may not have to file tax returns in India. I think, again, this would bring India or onshore structures at par with some of the overseas feeder vehicles that we are routinely designing for global LPs. I think these were two areas where they could have spent some more time.
Sure. I think a couple of other areas where government could have done a bit more in the budget is attracting foreign corporations, or rather retaining Indian corporations in India. And as all of us are aware, there is a race amongst countries today for attracting foreign corporations, which is where some of the anti-inversion rules have been drafted in domestic legislation. If you see the tax rates in some of the countries which are competing with India, Singapore is 17%. In fact, developed countries like UK and US have also drastically reduced their rates somewhere around 21 to 25%. And with the tax rates in India, even though we have 25% tax rate for corporations or companies which have turnover of less than 4 billion Indian rupees, it still does not capture some of the mega corporations which forms part of 0.7%. What government could have done is maybe have a flat rate for everybody rather than singling out corporations with turnover above 400 crore or 4 billion Indian rupees. Second is for generally the corporate tax rate could have been further lowered, because what is happening today is all the new ventures which are being set up, the preference of the founders is to set those new ventures in a foreign jurisdiction where the maximum value is captured, and India is only a local development arm or offshore arm where the profits, significant profits are not booked, which means we are losing out on significant value where some of these startups could become future unicorns. But these unicorns will be Singapore or US or UK companies with substantial business in India. So the company which will be listed will be a foreign company, not an Indian company. And which is where I think government needs to do some more rethinking on the corporate tax rates and see if that can be rationalized so that we don't lose out on some of the blockbuster unicorns of tomorrow just because of the tax regime in India today. I think the second point was on the jobs. Jobs was one major issue which Modi government faced in the previous tenure, and real estate sector is one sector which has the ability to employ maximum number of people. Unfortunately, apart from 1.5 lakh deduction for home loan taken for affordable housing, there has been no significant change which has been introduced in the budget to give impetus to the real estate sector. And real estate sector has been maximum impacted post demonetization, which has further resulted in the jobs falling and the problem that the government is facing. So I think something to do with real estate sector, if that sector would have got some impetus, maybe the job opportunities would have increased, which would have been good for Modi government in terms of projecting that they have done something with respect to the job growth. So with this, what we'll do, in fact, Nishit is here with us, and I would request Nishit to give his views on the budget and post that we can open the floor for questions.
Thank you, Nishit, and everybody around. That's very interesting. I'm sorry, there is a little correction, the sound is there with us. But I would do things. You already spent about an hour discussing all different aspects. The main thing I look at is the entire process of bringing exchanges in the budget is a flawed one. I think it is important to divorce the finance bill, particularly bringing exchanges, should be separately discussed. What happens today, so many changes are being brought in the budget in a short notice, without discussion on conceptual issues or philosophical issues or how we could be articulated and stuff like that. It causes a huge problem. Look at this budget. While a lot of great things that we talked about, some of the good things that have been done, but the thing we can look at is that who is hit the most? It's the common man. He's very badly hit. One, with petrol high prices going up. So it is a better one. It looks like a silent intrusion of the price hike in the life of an ordinary person. It doesn't differentiate between the rich and the poor, wherever you expect it. Number two, then look at what has happened to the market. With FPI and the taxi taxation, majority of the funds are getting impacted. Who is investing in the funds? Mutual funds, taxi, or foreign FI, the pension plans, and the other people. So what happens is that when you tax them so high, disproportionately high, you have a big problem. Because who is impacted is the common man who ultimately gets. It looks like this funds of billions of dollars at their disposal. But effectively what happens, ultimately it gets distributed to the pension plan, in the process it goes to the common man, right? So common man is hit in a very silent way, and look at how much loss common men suffered yesterday. Maybe whether intentional or unintentional, I have no idea. I'm sure it was unintentional, but I think the signals are a little conflicting. Finance minister, I said, no, we are not going to look at it. Bureaucrats said, no, we are rethinking about it. So market is in the state of confusion. So SPA, for example, was lower. Okay, when they invest, there is no tax on that. We take that. Before take that, and the tax goes to the next level, and the next level, and the next level. Such are. Was very small in maybe 2012-13, 2-3%, then went to 5 to 10 to now, here we can look at. So what happens, surcharge is a very silent intrusion, and once it's supposed to be temporary tax, generally it goes to the central government. But then there is never an effort to bring it back down. Money on the surcharge happens, maybe for 40, 50 years it continues, you know. So it happens that this kind of changes really must be brought in after sufficient discussion with the stakeholders, number one. And number two, that we should separate these changes from the normal budget introduction. There is enough time to discuss, to play all the decisions come, and now in 25 days time, hundreds of changes will be passed by the parliament. Not only the taxpayer is impacted adversely, but more importantly, on the tax enforcers or the officers for the tax, how do they make a decision? If they decide something in favor of taxpayer taking, interpretation of a particular provision, after retirement, you will be liable. So if state your source is to tax you, then you will appeal. Appeal goes for 8, 10, 20 years. So I think the entire process of, I think the practice, I think the bad practice to bring income tax, serious income tax, yeah, you may have some immediate changes or some procedural changes to bring in otherwise. But substantive changes should never be brought along with the budget, because there is no discussion either with the shareholders, there is no discussion in the parliament in 20, 25 days to pass laws without sufficient discussion. There is some point that they got only important issue highlighted, and then EIA and then go part into the budget. I think this is completely unfair, both to the taxpayers and also to the tax officers. We have to make their life easier. And this only widens the trust deficit that already exists between the tax department and the taxpayer. I think one of the things that was talked about before the budget was most important thing government has to do is to bring tax, cut the tax deficit apart from the fiscal deficit. I think this is where we are really lacking, and we are losing out to the world competition. Every country is looking at, to attract foreign investors. Every country is looking at to do so many things. Here we do things. Look at Startup India, Startup India, 16th of January 2016. We brought in, from the scheme, but it is 2019 and it will be in 2020. If we're still struggling, 5 years, 4 years have gone by. So what is the use of talking when things don't are in line? And because it is perhaps not the fault of government. Government would like our prime minister would always like to motivate people. No doubt about it. But it's bureaucrats' job to see they're implemented smoothly, and every time they try to put in place any process or otherwise, this is the official thinking that goes into it. And this is the biggest error this year. I do not want to go too long at this point in time, but I think it is very important to make sure that some of these changes that have been introduced, particularly in respect of SBI and the CATSI and other vehicles, also maybe the future funds and others, those are coming up. I think we'll have to change that. Otherwise, common management will be continuously harmed, Number one. Number two, that, as far as the new things are concerned, like Gandhinagar history, it was, idea came up in 2007, in 2011 or 12. How many years have gone by? 10 years, right? We have to move very fast forward. In 10 years' time, you know, today I remember Mauritius, okay, as I said in 1990, early 1990s or so, you know, all we are involved in developing that international center. In 30 years' time, what has happened? About 12% of national GDP comes from financial center. It has become one of the more sophisticated jurisdictions. So small countries can do this. We have, you know, we should have single-minded focus on the gifting in the country of Europe. And I think that will be another thing. It is a great idea. We can all be working on it. But speed is the big thing. I think, and that is where we should be doing. One of the things I would really like to see in GIFT City and, you know, unified regulatory authority has been set up so that all decisions can be taken. The tax department, I think, is not a part of it. It must become part of it. So that when any decision is taken, tax doesn't pull off the plug from behind, you know. And that would be my suggestion. I think we should not go too long at this point in time. We are already done up in spending this morning to listen to us, and I must thank everyone. And over to you, Mr. Mack, for your comments.
Sure, thanks, Nishit. We'll open the floor for questions from the participants.
Thank you very much. We will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question, you may press star and one on their touchtone telephone. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star and two. Participants are requested to use handsets while asking a question. Ladies and gentlemen, we will wait for a moment while the question queue assembles. A reminder to the participants, anyone who wishes to ask a question, you may press star and one now. Participants to ask a question, you may press star and one at this time. A reminder to the participants, anyone who wishes to ask a question, you may press star and one now.
Even if there are no questions, I think we can then wrap it up.
Sure, sir. Any closing comments?
No, I think we've gone on for long enough. Thanks, everyone, for joining in for this webinar. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of Nishit Desai Associates, that concludes this conference. Thank you for joining us, and you may now disconnect your lines.